Hey, what's going on, Sound Sessions? This is Michael Heidemann on behalf of Kevin Richter here at Sound Sessions Podcast. Just wanted to thank you guys so much for listening to this podcast today. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes to fill your ears with lots of really cool interviews from us. Search Sound Sessions WGN. Also, feel free to rate, review, and maybe even tell a friend, since it helps us immensely in the iTunes ranking and will allow us to continue bringing you great, great content. You can also check us out on Twitter at SoundSeshPod, Facebook, SoundCloud, Instagram, and we recently were added on Acast, so you can check us out there too. Or if you're feeling up to it, you can send us a good old-fashioned email at soundsessionspod@gmail.com. Now, without further ado, here is a true rock and roll vet, Tony Lovato from the band Mast. Yay,
yay! All right, I'm Flex Pavilion.
Hello, this is Andrew WK.
Yo, 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 it's Miles from Slack Stupid.
This is Ali.
This is Nick from Chick Chick Chick.
What's up, guys? The Chain Smoker. Is the name of school from Ghost?
This is Beefcake the Mighty from Guar.
Hey, folks, we're Royal Blood.
And you're currently listening to Sound Sessions.
Sound Sessions.
Sound Sessions.
Sound what?
Sound Sessions.
Sound Sessions.
You're listening to the sweet sounds of Sound Sessions. Thank you.
Hey, what's up, guys? This is Tony from the band Mast, and you're listening to Sound Sessions.
Chicago's rock pioneers. These guys started and helped steer the ship of the early to mid-2000s punk pop scene. Now true rock and roll veterans, Mast are back and live in Chicago with the other bands Show Off, Much the Same, Nightcap, and Bastardos playing live at the Concord Music Hall on January 16th. We are joined by Mast frontman Tony Lovato. Tony, thank you so much for coming in and joining us on Sound Sessions.
For sure, man. Thanks for having me.
So let's kind of take it back to the beginning for a second. Now, the group Mast actually started in a small town outside of Chicago. So what were those days like living in a small town playing music in the suburbs?
You know, looking back, I think those were some of the most fun times. You know, I mean, you're a teenager. You're sort of just growing up, becoming who you are. And, you know, you're learning to identify with, you know, music, and it was that stage in your life where you're, you know, trying to figure out who you are, and you start identifying with different scenes and music and looks and culture. And So for us, you know, we grew up on the south side of Chicago in a town called Blue Island. You know, we had our little punk rock scene back then, you know, and we'd play shows. When we played on the south side, we would play at a little club in Homewood called Off the Alley, which was sort of our Gilman Street, so to speak. And, you know, then we'd go up to the north side, and there was the Fireside Bowl. But we would just put on shows and, you know, rent out VFW halls and put on shows, pass out flyers, get as many kids there as possible. You know, we had a cool little scene at the time, you know. But, yeah, it was definitely some of the most fun years of, you know, your life and your, you know, sort of starting out, and you're sort of just doing this band thing as a hobby, and, you know, it slowly turned into something more than that.
Nice. You know, being a musician kind of myself, I remember when I was kind of growing up, I would always look towards the city as like my crown jewel. What were some of the venues where you were looking, like when you were playing these smaller shows, saying, you know what, we're going to make it once we play the Metro, or we play the House of Blues? What was your crown jewel back here in Chicago?
Yeah, I think that was, you know, I went and saw a concert at the Vic once, and I remember being there in the crowd and just being like, man, like, what would it be like to play a venue like this with this many people? And then the Metro was the spot for me. I mean, because I loved the record store, the clubhouse next door. Like, it was so much fun just to go down there with your friends and, you know, go hang out in the record store before and after the show. And, you know, the Metro it hosted pretty much every show that I would go to, because all the bands that I liked were, you know, that was their spot.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, I, for sure, the Metro was, I think, the place that, I mean, when we first started playing there and we did a Battle of the Bands for a Warped Tour, and then I got in touch with, or became friends with one of the sort of local promoters, and this guy that worked at the Metro. And because he worked at UPS also, and I happened to, that was what my day job was. I was working at UPS. So he sort of hooked me up with shows there. But So that was when it started getting exciting, was being able to play, you know, one of these clubs that I would constantly go to as a fan and everything. And then, you know, the first time that we sold it out, like, I remember just, like, it was a super emotional moment for me coming from this idea that, like, you know, I didn't know. I got kicked out of school when I was 15. I wasn't really sure what I was going to do with my life. And so this monumental moment of, like, wow, like, I just sold out the Metro, you know, and I was, like, 19 years old. Like, that was a pretty big, exciting, you know, chapter in my life.
Yeah, I could imagine. I'm sure it kicked the shit out of working for Brown.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, a really cool thing was going on in Chicago when you guys were kind of getting your start. When Mess was kind of at the peak, the city of Chicago was kind of on fire, putting out these artists like Fall Out Boy, The Academy Is, Alistair. Now, you were in the midst of kind of building this animal. Did you know you were on the verge of creating something like much more than a scene here in Chicago when you were playing music?
Yeah, I mean, I'll never be a person that will say that we, you know, created anything. I mean, I think we were, you know, it's more of a modest thing to me that we were just part of something. Mm-hmm. And there happened to be, I mean, if you look back, I think there's always been some very, very monumental bands come out of Chicago. I think it's one of those cities that has great culture and creates, you know, there's good artistry within Chicago in all different fields. And, you know, at the time we just got lucky. We were one of the bands that, you know, got signed and was able to, you know, keep putting out records and, you know, and then Fall Out Boy, they broke out. And like you said, The Academy Is, but, you know, before us was Alkaline Trio, and there was a band called Slapstick. I don't remember Slapstick, which Dan was in. Like, so there's always just a lot of rad Chicago bands. So I was just excited, you know, to be part of that, you know. Like, I wouldn't say that we were anything that, like, we weren't paving the way as much as we were just with everybody else pushing forward, you know?
Yeah, yeah. As a teen who would be listening to the music that you guys were putting out at the time, well, I was thinking more along the lines of, oh yeah, Mess definitely hangs out with Skiba and Alistair, and that must go out and do, you know, go to the restaurant together and get some dinner or something like that. Because it just seemed, yeah, I mean, seemed so real, like a family.
Yeah, I mean, with, you know, we took Fall Out Boy on pretty much their, like, first big national tour.
Mm-hmm.
And so we definitely bonded. I remember riding home in the back of the bus. It was like, we were riding home to our last show, one of our last shows, which was in the Chicago area, and Pete rode with us, and he was just sitting in the back, and he was like thanking me and for bringing him on tour. And he was saying how, you know, they were in a hard position at the time because they weren't getting a lot of tours, and nobody really wanted to take them out. And so he was just, you know, being grateful and thanking me for bringing them out because, you know, they couldn't get any of the tours at the time. And I was like, dude, of course, you guys are from Chicago. Like, it makes sense, you know? And, but yeah, and I mean, we're friends with them. You know, our last tour we did with the Alistair guys.
Mm-hmm.
They were actually on that tour. And, you know, every time I see Matt's a good dude. Like, me and Matt are friends. And so, I mean, everybody, you know, I think there's that common bond. And so once you meet and you become friends, it's one of those, like, okay, you're from Chicago, I'm from Chicago, all right, we're good. You know, it's like one of those things.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't it so strange that a lot of musicians, especially people here in the industry, they all have a tie to Chicago in one way or another?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's one of those cities that creates a lot of good artistry, you know?
Mm-hmm. What do you think it is about the city of Chicago that we kind of create? Is it because we're all stuck inside and it's freezing ice cold and there's nothing to do in the burbs that we want to just create and kind of expand, or what is it?
I mean, there is that thought that's possible. I mean, you know, that was the idea with Slipknot. Were they from like Ohio or some weird little bofunk town where everybody was like, why do you think that they're so good at what they do? Like, they had nothing else to fucking do but play music. And it's, you know, so there's that idea. But I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, New York sort of has their own thing and the West Coast sort of has their own thing. And so I think Chicago just, you know, sort of takes a little bit from everything, but then creates their own original sort of style and sound.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Now, speaking about family, you have the original lineup joining you for this upcoming show. So how does it feel to be back with the guys?
Yeah, it's awesome, man. It's one of those things where I personally I think all the guys generally thought that, you know, we would never be on the same stage together again.
Yeah.
Playing music. And it wasn't a thought that necessarily came out of animosity or resentment or anything like that. It was more the lines of everybody had just moved on, and so many years had passed that, mm-hmm. you know, there's like that idea when you break up with a girl, like after like 6 months, like maybe see each other and it's cool. And then like, and there's that thought of maybe it's going to work. And then as time goes on, you just realize, okay, everything's moved on. You're at the next chapter in your life. And that's sort of where it felt that it was going. And I went out, I made a record with a couple of the musician friends of mine that was in a side project with me. And I started writing some songs that were more geared in the Mest world. So when I put it out, we actually put it out as a Mest record. Mm-hmm. And Nick has done a couple side projects, and with some of the guys from Suicide Machines, he was actually in a side project with some of the guys from Show Off, and Matt and Jer had their own side projects. So other things were happening. So it was one of those things where I think we just figured it was done, you know, and we just decided, you know, I talked to my cousin a little bit and talked to Nick, and then we were like, fuck it, let's just, oops, sorry, I don't know if you can do that on this, if you can swear. And
oh, you can, fuck yeah, you can.
Oh, sweet, okay. you know, it was just one of those things where I think enough time had passed and we were sort of just like, wonder what it would be like to get back on stage again. And just threw out a couple text messages and everybody was just into it that quick, you know. And our first rehearsal back together, because we actually did our first reunion show back in May, and that was at House of Blues Anaheim. And I remember flying in for the first, sorry, I'm getting sick, flying in for the first rehearsal, and I remember like walking into Matt's basement and, you know, moving some gear around to like set up a little rehearsal spot and just hanging out with everybody for the first time in, you know, virtually 10 years. And it was cool. Like it wasn't awkward, which was a good thing, because you never know going into those situations. Like you haven't seen, you know, you haven't been together as a group in fucking 10 years.
Yeah.
And so you never know if it's going to be real awkward, because if it is, then you're just stuck in that fucking room for, you know, 12 hours rehearsing and mm-hmm. it's just awkward. But it wasn't, man. And everybody's got, I think, you know, there's a little bit of maturity that comes with age, obviously. And it was one of those things where everybody was just sort of good to see each other, and the fucking jokes started again, and, you know, like it felt normal again, you know, which was a really good thing.
Nice. So there wasn't that like Fleetwood Mac vibe that you guys had going on.
No, none of us were sleeping with each other either. So
that that's good. But you never say never, right?
Well, I mean, me and my cousin, they'd be a little weird. They'd be a little extra weird.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you guys are back, because, you know, that original sound that you guys created, it was magnetic. It was strong, and it really, really touched a lot of people. I'm guessing that there's no rust on the shelves, and it's kind of just back to business as usual, huh?
It was, you know, before our show, during that rehearsal back in May, and we got up on stage and played the show, like, you know, I've seen some of the footage. And it was cool to think that we, after 10 years, got together and rehearsed one day for 12 hours, got back up there and played a, you know, an hour and 15 minutes. As if we didn't skip a beat, you know, it was cool. And I think that sort of stems from the fact that we weren't just a band that got together of like through like classified ads or anything like that. You know, mm-hmm. my cousin was the bassist. I've known Nick since I was 15. I've known Jeremiah since I was 10. So we were always friends and family. And so this band was more than just a band. There was a bond. There was a friendship. And then, you know, all the our friends and our kids in our neighborhood that we grew up with, all those people ended up becoming crew guys. And one of them became a guitar tech. One of them was a drum tech. One guy came out as our lighting guy or merch guy. So no matter where we traveled in the world, we were always together. When we were off the tour, we were at home hanging out. So, you know, it was a cool thing to have your family and your friends just traveling and doing everything with you. So it was a good amount of years, man. It was fun.
Wow. See, that speaks so highly to the fact that family does play a huge part in these bands, because you are with these people every single day of the week, every single day. There's most of the time you spend more time with your bandmates than you do with your family.
Absolutely. I've always said that, and most musicians will say that, you know, being in a band is, it's like having three girlfriends, you know, like you have to, because there's compromise and, you know, understanding and respect, and you have to have that. And, you know, the reality why the band sort of split up was because we had spent so many years together. People don't realize it, but we had already put out, I think, 5 records, mm-hmm. and we had been a band for 12 years. Like,
wow.
And we were at that point in our lives where it was like, what's next? Everybody was sort of at that stage. And it wasn't that we didn't love playing music or being in the band, but it was just sort of like we were burnt. We were burnt out.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because we had been doing it for 4 years, 5 years for fun, just before the band got signed. We were playing shows and hustling and all that stuff. And once we got signed, it was, we went into that cycle of where you write a record, go in and record the record, go out on tour. Once you're done with, you know, the year and a half of promoting and touring, go back in, write a record, get back in the studio and record, you know, where it's just a cycle. And it's like you never actually get a real break.
Yeah.
And we spent a lot of years on the road. That's how we built our career, because we were, you know, we never really had a radio hit. So for us, it was a lot of touring, you know, so we were just burnt.
Yeah, that, you know, it's, I guess that's debatable, because I mean, you, a lot of the songs you put out, like Cadillac and everything, were huge hits. But I guess, yeah, I guess I wouldn't really turn to the radio to hear a mess song.
In the classified word of hit on the radio, we've never had a hit song. We've had songs that have gotten small attention on the radio. One being the fucking song that I hate more than anything, which was off of our first record, which I don't even want to talk about. But it was a joke. It was a joke song that we wrote. Like, one of my favorite bands is NoFX, and they write these like hokey joke songs within their punk rock records. And so I wrote a stupid joke song. And it just so happened that like Smash Mouth and Sugar Ray and those types of bands were doing good on radio at the time. So fucking the label heard that and they were like, this is our hit. And we're just like, what? And, you know, you start like, they're going to pick what singles they want. You know, you can only fight so much with a label for the single that you want. But what that song eventually did was, you know, it made us actually have to go out then and tour and tour and tour to show people, look, this is not what our band is. We're not that fucking hokey song. Like, we write punk rock songs. Like, we're a pop punk band. And, you know, we had to work hard for that. But the ending result was that by, you know, at the end of our second record, we could go out and headline. And we were doing a headlining tour of, you know, House of Blues sized venues with only 80,000 records sold. And 80,000 records back in the day on a major label was a flop and they would drop you. But the label knew, okay, they've only sold 80,000 records, but they're selling out all these shows.
Yeah.
So something's working. And so it was just, you know, and they wouldn't drop us because they knew if we went to another label, and then all of a sudden this label's actually able to produce a real radio hit, then they're going to look terrible. You know, like the band's done everything right. You know, it's all politics within the business side of shit, but
yeah,
you know, I mean, yeah, we've never really had a radio hit per se, but
that's so interesting, you know? Because I guess like it really comes from where your songwriting process and then how much of your soul do you want to sell, I guess, to create those radio hits.
Right. And that's the thing is that for me, Cadillac's only one step away from the other song.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
But, you know, like, the reality is, like, if you listen to that, that's what sort of sucks in the music business, is that I could be talking to anybody, you know, they're like, yeah, I listen to punk music, this and that, blah, blah, blah. Or, no, I've never heard of your band. And then somebody could be like, oh, have you heard the song Cadillac? And they'd be like, oh, yeah. And they're like, oh, well, that's the band. And it's like, but that's not what the band was, because you can go back and listen to so many of the other songs and the lyrical content and the music in it. There's a lot of serious, real songs written, you know?
Oh yeah.
And then you have the label go and put out a single, and then that's the representation of your band to a lot of people. So, you know, that's the bad part about radio singles, I guess.
Yeah, like when you guys were playing music and coming up and like kind of, I see where you're saying is you were kind of like packaged in that certain way. How do you see the difference with today's artists, the way that they can kind of prepackage themselves and put them their own music online? Do you wish you had that, or are you happy with how it went about?
You know, I'm a grateful person for everything that comes in my life, and I think that you can take anything that's negative and make, you know, you could find some positive in it and work through things and get the best out of something. So I'm 100% grateful for everything that's ever happened in my career and with the band and stuff like that. There were some hard things to get over, but, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, what a lot of these kids don't realize, a lot of the fans, at least back in the day too, because it's a weird thing now, because a lot of the pop punk bands, is like, you know, the new, and even newer than us, I guess now people call us old school, which is really fucking weird.
Yeah. I'm sure it's strange.
A lot of these new pop punk bands that are coming up, I mean, they're literally pop bands. Like, they're writing pop songs. And not that I like pop music. I like, a good song can be played in any genre. It's a good song. Good songwriters are good songwriters. I'm not like hating on that or anything, but we caught so much shit where it was like, you're not a punk band. And it's like, what? Like, all I grew up listening to was punk rock music from like Minor Threat, Operation Ivy and Rancid and Green Day and NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion. Like, that's Face to Face. That's all the shit I grew up listening to. So that was all my influences. So if we weren't a punk rock band, I don't know what we were then, because that's all I grew up listening to. Just because all of a sudden, there's technically Maverick wasn't even a major label. They were an independent label. They were a subsidiary. But it's like, oh, it's Madonna's label. So you're on a major label, you know? And it's like, little do a lot of people know, they're like, and this is not taking anything away from Fall Out Boy, but that entire first record they did, like the blue one where they're all on the cover.
Yeah.
That entire record, although put out on Fueled by Ramen, was marketed and pushed by Island Def Jam because they were smart about it. They said, let's market them as, keep them on the indie label, get the kids stoked, get the kids happy. They're an independent, you know, rock band doing it. It was all marketed by Island Def Jam. They were already on that label, but they were smart about marketing because they knew that kids will, you know, more likely come, you know, if it's coming from a Fueled by Ramen label, then it's like acceptable and it's cool. So they were smart about the marketing.
Yeah,
but it really was just
really smart.
Island Def Jam the entire time, you know, and then, you know, then they do the crossover and go over to MTV and become massive. And, you know, it's great. I mean, that's what they ended up needing to be anyways. Like the songs Patrick writes, he writes top 40 songs, you know, like, but there's so much marketing and so much shit that goes into that type of stuff that is strategically thought out that fans don't even realize it's happening.
Yeah, the veil is over the eyes, especially when it comes to those record labels. Because, I mean, I'm sure that most of our listeners, this was a bombshell to them. Because the way that Island Def Jam kind of put out that album, it was like they were their hometown band. And little did they know that it was just all part of a strategy that they had going on.
It was a great, great fucking marketing plan.
Oh, yeah.
100% worked, you know.
You know, so you've been playing these shows. You got your side project now, London Falling. We got to make mention of that real quick. Now, what made you want to kind of get into that and kind of separate yourself from Mest a little bit?
You know, to be honest, the main reason why is because with the original lineup of Mest, which I would love to do another Mest record. I would love to be able to get on the road and fucking tour with the guys 6 to 9 months out of the year. Like, but they can't do that. They all have gone into fields and careers where they are working their 401k the rest of their lives. Like that's, and they all have good jobs and they got families to support. And I fully understand that. So we've talked about doing another record, and it just, to me, it was one of those things where if I write another Mest record, it's cool. It's going to be great. Like fans will be stoked. I would make a little bit of money from putting out a new record and all that stuff makes sense. But in the long run, as a career move, it's not going to do anything for me because I can't put out a record and then play 10 to 15 shows a year promoting it with the guys, because that's not how records are successful these days. You have to tour.
Yeah.
You know, like radio doesn't do shit anymore. You have to get out there and promote the record. And So it wouldn't do anything for me with my career. And so as I started writing songs again, essentially what would have became the best songs, I would say, I just had to think about what's the best way to release this. You know, how can I get on the road and tour? And so I've been thinking about it one day, like literally the next day I'm sitting at my parents' house and mm-hmm. sitting by the pool hanging out, summertime, and LP, the drummer of Yellow Card, threw me a text randomly and was like, "Hey man, hope all is well. If you ever need a drummer for any studio stuff or anything like that, or for touring, just let me know." And I was like, it's so weird, because like literally the day before I was thinking about like, I want to put out this record, like how should I do it, and just trying to figure out the next career move, so to speak. And so I just ran the idea past him. What's up?
It's fate.
Yeah, it was a weird sort of, you know, weird thing. And so I just told him what was going on in my life and with the band and the situation I was in. And, you know, I was like, what do you think about maybe doing this record together, you know? And he was just like, dude, I'm in. Like, it would be awesome. Mm-hmm. And since then, we've had a couple members come and go, but only due to their schedules. But I had... I talked to Tom Denny, who used to formerly was in a band called The Day to Remember. And he's always been a big Mest fan. So I was like, hey, man, would you want to maybe do this project together? And he writes, you know, the songwriter and stuff. So he was like, yeah, man. And he was into it. And we're like, all right, let's start writing some songs. And now he's doing movies.
Wow.
And he pretty much, he has a very bad taste in his mouth from the music business. I.e. probably because they were there on Victory Records, and I'm sure you've heard many of the outcomes that have happened to the bands on Victory Records.
So no comment.
I think that's why. I'm assuming, because like, he's like, you know, I've sold however many records he told me he sold, and he goes, and I haven't seen one royalty check. And I'm like, well, you might want to work on that then. Something's not right. So he sort of doesn't want to even be in the music business anymore. And I said, all right, dude, no worries, man. We're still boys. Everything's cool. And then, sorry if I'm sniffling like crazy. I somehow got sick. I've been traveling the past 12, 13 days, just flying in and out, just dirty, filthy, fucking sick people everywhere. So I've somehow...
Got to take that emergency. For all, everyone who's going to be at their show on January 16th, make sure you bring Tony lots and lots of emergency and fluids.
Yeah, we'll do shots of emergency. So then I hit up my buddy Paul, who played bass in the band Good Charlotte, and we've stayed friends over the years. And so we were just catching up and talking about, you know, he's got a couple kids, and I was telling him about my new son, and we were just bullshitting for a little bit, and I told him the idea, and he was totally into it. And and then Good Charlotte got back together, mm-hmm. and I was like, you're probably not going to be able to do this, huh? And he's like, he's going to school now, too. He's like, so with school and Good Charlotte, he's like, dude, I'm going to be so busy. And he's like, but I'll do the record still. So he might play bass on some songs, like on the record and stuff, just because we've always wanted to do a project together. So, but we just ended up recording our first 5 songs in L.A., over the past week, and I actually had this amazing fucking bassist named Ronnie. How do you say his last name? Ronnie Ficarro, mm-hmm. spelled weird. But he played in I Am Ghost? But he was in Falling in Reverse.
Oh, right on. Year. Yeah.
So, and his thing is he always grew up loving pop punk music. Mm-hmm. So when I, you know, threw this idea at him, he was like, fuck yeah. So when he came in and played bass on the songs, it was awesome. Like, it was like, it just fit so well. And I could tell that this is his world of music, is playing, you know, like punk songs. And so, yeah, the reason why I did London Falling was because I wanted to be able to put out these songs that I'm writing, which in one way or another sort of messed songs, but be able to tour on them and have another chapter in my life. And so, you know, to the Mest fans, I think they'll be pretty stoked, because in a way it's still a Mest record, you know,
yeah,
but just with some different musicians. And in a way for me, it's able to still continue to move forward, like as an artist and as a songwriter, and be able to write, you know, a little bit out of the box, but keep it to what I like and what I do.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it too, because now I saw on the list that you're playing as Mast and London Falling is opening. So this is double booking for you, correct?
Well, okay, so on the show in March, when we come through on the Three-Headed Monster, which is Mast, the Ataris, and Hawthorne Heights, the tri-headliner, that show in Chicago, Mast isn't doing.
Okay.
Only London Fallen is doing that show. That has to do with promoter conflict. Well, not conflict, but where, you know, you just can't play the same market too close to each other when you're
That's right, two different
promoters and two different buyers. So due to the show that we're doing this Saturday, we couldn't really do that show. But even if we had did it, it would have been not the original members of Mast anyways.
Okay.
Because the Three-Headed Monster, it's me and the guys that are in London Falling doing the Mast set together, but opening up as London Falling too. Well, we're doing one of the support slots.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that works out though well. So I mean, come on though. This is the show to see. January 16th at the Concord Music Theater. Now I had a quick question. You did mention your son. Now most of your listeners and the people who kind of grew up with you in Mast have little ones themselves. Did you ever see yourself becoming the punk rock dad? And how has that affected you over the few years, like touring and songwriting?
Yeah, I always wanted to be a father. I was, you know, I have a really close relationship with my father and always loved kids. My brother had a son at the age of 17, my nephew Brandon. So I grew up with him and, you know, I sort of played the role of father, uncle, big brother. All my friends, you know, being in the same age range, I started having kids and I've always been super close with all my friends' kids. And so I always wanted a son. But the only way to have a son is to do that with a female that's not, you know, that you're compatible with.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to find that for a lot of people. So I was actually sort of at that stage in my life where I was sort of like, maybe I'm just supposed to be like the cool uncle to everybody. You know, maybe that's just not in my cards. And I sort of just accepted that. And I was like, I'll still get my fix from all my friends. Kids and be part of their lives, but you know, this is not my past. And then I met my girlfriend and it happened and it's awesome, man. Like I, you know, that's the thing is that right now, like you said, a lot of the fans that grew up with Mast also have kids now and are in this stage of their life. So probably the songs that I'm writing in London Falling are going to be very, very relatable to, you know, my generation of people, because it's a lot about growing up and about different, just seeing life in a completely different perspective.
Yeah.
Because once you have kids, things do change. Like that, the attitude of, I don't give a fuck what people think. And you're like, you really don't give a fuck what people think anymore, because it doesn't matter anymore. There's one thing in your life that matters and it's your kid, and everything revolves around your kid, you know, like that's your life.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
A lot of the songs written are written in that sort of perspective. And a lot of songs are written too with the idea of, you know, the different stages in life and going through different stages and being able to accept where you're at in life and not trying to rush things when you're a kid. Or when you're an adult thinking, you know, realizing that you don't know everything. Like sometimes the younger generation has figured out something better than the older generation, you know? And so the lyrical content, you know, that changes things a lot, you know, once you have a kid.
Yeah. Tony, that's deep.
Yeah, it happens sometimes.
You know, I'm sure that it's going to affect you in a positive way, because it's always like when you least suspect it that you find that kind of girl of your dreams, and then all of a sudden your life shifts and you don't even notice it.
Yeah, it was very random and out of nowhere, and we definitely rushed into things and just kept it going, and we were sort of just like, well, this is sort of what we've done individually our entire lives, and you know, I met her in Los Angeles, and it just happened that she actually grew up in Arlington Heights.
Oh, wow.
So there was, yeah, so there's a weird, like, you know, weird connection there where it's like, oh, we're both from Chicago. And so, you know, luckily things have worked out for the best.
That's actually pretty cool. That's pretty cool. So I guess the next question I have to ask is, what is the least punk rock thing you've done since you become a dad? What are those movies that your kids are making you watch, or what are those toys you're playing with?
You know what? Let me think. There's, I mean, I gotta be honest, man. My kid's pretty punk rock.
Yeah.
He pretty much does whatever he wants. Yeah.
Nice.
But yeah, man, you know what it is? It's not even about the stuff that he's making me do or making me watch. How I saw it was, I've always wanted, like, I like the idea of being a kid at heart, you know. Realize, you know, obviously you have your priorities as an adult and the things you have to do, but my idea is, you know, I've always wanted to stay young at heart and be a kid in my head. And, you know, obviously being a musician, if you're a musician, you pretty much have like the Peter Pan syndrome anyways, mm-hmm. where you never want to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
So having my son, it now just gives me an excuse to watch all the weird Pixar movies that I loved anyways, to go to the movies and see them and to do all these things. Like, I love the holiday season. It's my favorite time of the year. So having my kid now, it's even better because it's like you're living it through his eyes again, which, you know, it's just an exciting thing. So,
yeah.
I don't know, man. There's nothing like I'm not that type of dad, man. I have a fucking bad mouth, and his first word's probably going to be a swear word, and but that's okay.
Nice.
Like, that's just the way it is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I really kind of grow in that. I think that's a really cool thing for your listeners and the people who grew up with you and listening to your music, really like to hear the fact that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. You know, you are going to make transitions, and man, you've transitioned in the best kind of way.
Thanks, man. Appreciate that.
That's Tony Lovato. He is going to be playing at the Concord Music Hall with the epic, legendary Chicago punk pop band Mast on January 16th. Be sure to check them out. Tony, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate you coming on with Sound Sessions.
For sure, man. And let's not fail to mention all the other bands that are playing with us. Show Off, who's also a legendary pop punk band.
Exactly.
Back in the day. Much the Same, who were an awesome band, still are. They got back to, they're actually just recently reunited to do a couple of these shows. And then there's Nightcap, who's pretty much like a little brother of mine. It's his band. I've been playing the punk rock scene now for probably 10 years. And a band called, what is it? Bastard? I don't know how to say it.
Bastardos?
It's Bastardist.
Bastardist.
There's all these different ways to say it. And then that's Nick, our drummer from mm-hmm. Mast. That's his side project with Rich, who's in the Suicide Machines, and one of his buddies, Tony. So make sure to check out all those bands, too.
This is a huge show you put together, and I cannot wait to be there for it. It's going to be amazing. Again, it's at the Concord Theater here in Chicago. Tony, you're the best, man. Thank you again for coming on.
Thanks, man. Thanks for the interview. I'm so faded and reckless, not sorry, and I'll never regret these years. I'll never regret these years.
Can't get enough of Sound Sessions? Like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter @SoundSeshPod, and check us out on Instagram @SoundSessionsWGN.